It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy in for Bill Radke today. Right now, members of the Electoral College are casting votes, the votes that actually decide who will be president of the United States. While Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, Donald Trump received the majority of electoral votes, making him the winner of the general election. KLCC's Tiffany Eckhart has this refresher on our national system of representation and how two electors plan to vote.
Most Americans don't give much thought to the Electoral College until it comes time to vote. Even then, an understanding of how this esoteric system actually works could be based on the kind of grade you got in high school civics class. In 1788, Alexander Hamilton wrote the Federalist Papers, number 68. There were 13 states in the Union, all tucked along the Atlantic seaboard. Hamilton described the mode of electing America's first president.
That the people of each state shall choose a number of persons as electors equal to the number of senators and representatives of such state in the national government, who shall assemble within the state and vote for some fit person as president.
States vary in their methods of choosing electors. In Oregon, dedication and service to a political party is prerequisite. Republicans choose 7 electors at state and district conventions. For Democrats, it's the chair and or vice chair of the party and the chairs of congressional districts who become electors. In 2015, Democrat Laura Gilpatrick was elected chair of Oregon's 4th congressional district. With that, she became a Democratic elector.
Well, the basic responsibility is going to be to go up and vote in Salem on December 19th and vote for the candidate who won the Oregon election, which in this case was Hillary Clinton.
Gilpatrick doesn't expect much pomp and circumstance when casting her electoral vote.
We'll be gathering in the state Senate chamber, and we will essentially be signing a piece of paper voting for Hillary Clinton. The neat thing is your signature goes into the National Archives for all posterity.
Going into it, Gilpatrick says she thought she'd be casting an electoral vote for the first woman president.
But then election night, when the dust sort of settled, it's like, well, this is going to be a little bittersweet.
In Washington state, 12 electors are selected by peers in a caucus and convention process. That's how Brett Chiafalo became a Democratic elector. Like Oregon, Washington also elected Hillary Clinton for president. But come Monday, Chiafalo will not be casting his electoral vote for her.
After seeing Donald Trump win the election, we decided that based on our knowledge of the Federalist Papers and the Constitution and what the Founding Fathers truly set up about how the president is elected, that we had no choice but to start working towards having 37 Republican electors vote for a compromise candidate.
Chiafalo and a handful of others calling themselves Hamilton electors are committed to cast their electoral votes for a moderate Republican candidate, someone who Republican defectors could get behind, he says. Chiafalo considers parts of Hamilton's Federalist 68 to be the instruction manual.
The process of election affords a moral certainty that the office of president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications.
As a faithless elector, Chiafalo will vote against his party and against his state's popular vote for Clinton. He says he's putting country before party.
By showing honor to the Constitution and the Founding Fathers' intentions, we believe that that's a much higher calling and a much higher bar than a pledge to a political party.
Pundits are already dismissing the possibility of an Electoral College revolt. They say Donald Trump's electoral lead is too high. And even if 37 electors did bolt, state legislatures under the Constitution have the power to choose or change the slate of electors if they don't agree with their decisions, faithless or otherwise. Chiafalo says he spends about 20 hours a day reaching out to Republican electors around the country. He knows it's a long shot, but he thinks it's worth it.
The idea of kicking in the emergency brake because of a purely unfit candidate who won the general election has never happened before. And we've never had a threat as unprecedented as Donald Trump.
Alexander Hamilton described it like this.
talents for low intrigue and the little arts of popularity may alone suffice to elevate a man to the first honors in a single state. But it will require other talents and a different kind of merit to establish him in the esteem and confidence of the whole Union.
Regardless of how the Hamilton electors fare, Cefalo hopes to start a national conversation about how we elect presidents.
I think Americans assume it's a democracy, and it's not. And we need to talk about it. We need to decide whether we need a constitutional amendment, if we're going to go with direct popular vote or ranked choice voting or instant runoff.
On Monday, members of the Electoral College in 51 U.S. jurisdictions will cast their votes. On January 20th, the 45th President of the United States will take the oath of office. With Claude Offenbacher reading the words of Alexander Hamilton, I'm Tiffany Eckert.
A $6,000 round trip from Olympia to Vancouver, British Columbia. That's what it cost Washington taxpayers for a flight that Commissioner of Public Lands Peter Goldmark took last June. It's just one of dozens of chartered flights the outgoing Democrat has taken during his second term in office. In collaboration with the News Tribune of Tacoma, Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has our investigation.
This is the sound of a twin-engine King Air taking off, like the one piloted by two Washington State troopers on the afternoon of Wednesday, June 8th. The Washington State Patrol owns a small fleet of planes that state agencies and officials can charter. The King Air can carry up to seven passengers, but on that day there were just two on board, Lands Commissioner Peter Goldmark and his communications director, Sandra Kaiser.
Our target's out there at about 10 o'clock position.
The flight from Olympia to Vancouver, British Columbia, took about an hour. Over the next day and a half, the Lands Commissioner met with the U.S. Consul General, spoke at a firefighter's breakfast, and talked to graduate students in forestry. The next afternoon, the State Patrol plane returned to Vancouver to take the two back to Olympia. The State Patrol later billed the Department of Natural Resources $6,068.32 for that round trip.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
This is Republican State Representative Joel Kretz.
I'm sitting here thinking of how many fire hoses could we buy for that, you know?
Kretz is a Northeast Washington rancher who's been a critic of the Department of Natural Resources' firefighting efforts. Goldmark oversees the DNR, and it's more than 5 million acres of state land. We also asked former Commissioner of Public Lands, Brian Boyle, also a Republican, about the chartered flight to Vancouver. He calls Goldmark a pretty scrupulous guy, but says...
No, I wouldn't do that.
How come?
Just, you know, the idea that the State Patrol was going to do two round trips to get me there, I wouldn't allow that.
But Goldmark defends taking the charter flight to Vancouver.
I thought it was appropriate to use those resources, those state resources, to lessen the amount of time that I would be engaged in transit.
The trip to Vancouver, B.C. is the most expensive of more than 40 trips Commissioner Goldmark has taken aboard State Patrol aircraft during his second term. Average cost per trip, about $2,000. The only elected official to fly more is Governor Jay Inslee. He logged over 120 flights during the same time period. Records show the only other statewide elected official to charter a State Patrol plane during this time was Secretary of State Kim Wyman. She flew twice. As for Goldmark, records reveal that his use of chartered planes increased dramatically from just two trips in 2013 to 17 trips in 2015. Goldmark says that's in part because of back-to-back record fire seasons.
So that's been a very important uptick in my need for travel.
Our analysis shows about half of Goldmark's chartered flights have been to rural eastern Washington communities not served by commercial air carriers. But he's also flown in State Patrol aircraft to places like Spokane, Pullman, and Walla Walla that are served by Alaska or Horizon. Goldmark says he flies commercially when convenient. He also sometimes flies himself. He's a licensed pilot with his own plane. But Goldmark makes no apologies for using state planes to fly him out of Olympia to save time, even on short hops around Puget Sound.
I don't think that the people of the state of Washington want me stranded on I-5 as opposed to pursuing their good work.
Goldmark also notes that up until 2009, his agency had its own King airplane at a cost of about $500,000 a year. The legislature forced the sale of the King Air during the Great Recession, a move Goldmark opposed, but now he says it's saving taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars.
We've tightened the belt there, we sold the aircraft, and we've been using the King Air and the remainder of the State Patrol aircraft very judiciously.
A trip aboard a chartered state plane usually begins at the Olympia Airport. In the State Patrol's gleaming hangar, there are two King Airs, plus a single-engine Cessna. Lieutenant Jim Nobach says a State Patrol flight can cut a 2 or 3 day business trip down to just one.
We mainly leave it up to the state agencies to figure out what makes the best business sense for them, whether they fly commercial or they fly us.
Republican State Representative Joel Kretz says he's not going to second-guess Goldmark's flying habits, but he adds the cost and the optics matter, especially since Goldmark has been warning that his agency doesn't have enough money to combat the threat of wildfires.
You've got to make sure that agency looks pretty tight and clean and frugal to have much sympathy in the legislature.
Goldmark leaves office in January. His successor is Democrat Hillary Franz, who did not respond to our request for comment. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy, filling in for Bill Radke. Late last week, Rita Zawida finally got through to her family and friends in Aleppo, Syria. Rita runs the Salaam Cultural Museum here in Seattle. And in recent weeks, as the war got worse in eastern Aleppo, civilians sent their children out of the city with strangers and waited to be evacuated. Rita didn't know what was happening on the ground, but she told Bill Radke her friends and family in Aleppo are okay for now.
But the war's getting closer to them. They're hearing more of the bombings. My daughter's best friend, her house was bombed, so they lost half of their house a couple days ago, and her brother was injured. You know, so it becomes very hard. It's there's no electricity, no water. You know, they have to buy water. Electricity, it's the same thing. There's somebody that comes by and they'll sell you, so they'll plug in your electricity. And also, a lot of people just go during the day with just natural lighting, and at night it's with candles because you can't afford it. I mean, 6 years of war, how much money do you have? I mean, you don't really have banks to go to, and you don't have credit cards to use.
And this is all on the western side of
Europe. This is all on the western side. So imagine on the eastern side where there's pretty much nothing at all. I mean, it's really bad. And, you know, with the last couple of days, you've had the evacuations taking place. And they start saying, okay, the evacuations, they do it for one day, and then it stops. And, you know, Russians stopped it today or yesterday. They stopped the evacuations. They had people on the buses. They started moving the buses out. And then those buses were stopped at a checkpoint. Everyone was told to get off the buses. All of their personal belongings were confiscated from them, is what we were told. And then they were told to walk back home. That was it. And so you have injured the elderly, everyone you can imagine. You know, they're all hoping to get out to a safer zone.
What's this like for you being in Seattle watching this?
You know, I think the hardest thing is when I used to live in Syria, we didn't have social media to the extent that we have it now, so you could hear everything that was happening. Now you hear everything, but you have to filter through everything. So you actually don't have any idea, are some of the stories true, are they not? So I try not to even watch that. I just try and listen to the people that I know that are there. The work that I do is humanitarian work. We send stuff into Syria. So we ask the people that are going in. We have an orphanage up in Idlib, which is about 30 minutes from Aleppo, and it's very close to the Turkish border. So we have 37 young children that are there that have lost all their parents, and they've been in that orphanage for 3 years, and they're all underground. And so it's the caregivers that we've hired that take care of them, that tell us the stories. There's no way we can get them out at all, because then we'd be human smugglers. They don't have paperwork. We don't know family. We have no nothing on them, you know, so it's very, very difficult. There's only so much you can do. And then the U.S. makes it very difficult as an NGO to actually send things into Syria. You can't write the name Syria on a wire draft. They'll stop your wire drafts. I mean, they make it impossible to really try and help the people. So you end up having to be doing it illegally. And nobody wants to break the law, but, you know, there's no other way that I can get funds in.
Rita, you have gone to refugee camps in Jordan. to work with Syrian refugees. You're still coordinating volunteers to go to refugee camps. What's happening in the camps as news comes out of Aleppo that people can't get out? Evacuations aren't happening. Relief supplies are only trickling in.
People are very upset. I mean, you can imagine. I mean, it's like when earthquake happens or something happens in the U.S. and you're trying to get a hold of relatives. It's the same thing for these people in the camps. They don't know. I mean, some of the people left with all their families. Others did not leave with their families. I mean, you have huge extended families, and they can't get through to the families. They don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going to go. And even inside the camps, people have been split up. Families have been split. You know, there's no coordination with the government or UNHCR or these organizations that they might bring a mother and her kids and they'll leave the father behind. A lot of people are getting upset staying in the camps for so long. They thought it was short term. So we've had Zaatari camp, which is the biggest camp in Jordan. It started out with 20,000 people. What happened then? It got up to 185,000 people. So it became the fifth largest city in all of Jordan as a refugee camp. Now the numbers are down to about 75,000 to 85,000 people. A lot of those people have either moved into the city or they've gone back to Syria because they said, if I'm going to die, something's going to happen to me or my kids are going to get raped or hurt. Let me do it in my own country. I'm just not willing to stay here any longer.
Recently, just a few days ago, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations talked about the situation in Aleppo and asked the Syrian ambassador whether he was incapable of shame. Do you think the United States has done enough in Syria?
Seriously? No, not at all. I'm very, very, I think a lot of people are, we're sort of upset with Obama. You know, he just has not taken a stand. He's sort of stepped back. He didn't do a no-fly zone. He hasn't. He's offered, okay, I can get some troops in, but not many. He just not helped at all. He's let Russia take over, in a sense. So the U.S. could do a lot more. I mean, when they limited the amount of refugees even to be allowed into the U.S. to 10,000, that's disgusting. That's totally disgusting. I mean, there's no reason. I mean, how do you come up with a number like that? You know, when you've had Europe and other people that are willing to take them in, look at how many Germany took in. You know, and the U.S. could also have done things to use their power to tell other countries in Europe to open those borders. You need those borders open. You couldn't just close the borders and people were risking their lives to get from Syria to Turkey and then from Turkey to take the boats across and land in Greece on the islands, and then they're walking up through Europe and then stuck at European borders, and rubber bullets and other things were being shot at them. If that happened anywhere else in the world, can you imagine Canada shooting rubber bullets at the U.S., at people that are camping out? There would be something said. Our president didn't say a damn thing.
What could he do about opening borders in Europe?
Well, he can turn around and talk to the European heads of states. I mean, he could have stopped the EU making a negotiations with Turkey, which he did, and said, okay, Turkey, we'll pay you so much money, and you take these Syrians in. Turkey turned around, took the money, closed the border, and said, well, that's it. We can do what we want to do. And so the people that were going across and spending all their hard-earned money to pay human smugglers $1,500, $1,000 to be on these boats, on these rescue boats. We were on the other side, my people, and we were meeting those refugees as they were coming through. U.S. didn't bother to do anything. Look at all the help they're giving in Mosul, right? But why is it the same thing that they're not doing in Syria? Why can't they force the government to let food drop in, you know, and stop the bombing of hospitals and schools and churches and mosques? They're not saying anything. I mean, that's what's upsetting, is he is not saying a word.
I understand that you have said that Islamophobia is one reason the U.S. hasn't done more. Is that your feeling?
Yeah, there is a lot of that, definitely. You see that, you know, you saw that right after 9/11. And you're seeing it now, actually, with Trump, that is brought hate back in, and people that can pretty much say anything they want and won't feel like there's nothing going to happen to them. We're seeing so many cases of it here in Seattle with young girls at the schools that are going, that is happening, things that are happening in malls. We're seeing it with the new refugees that are coming in here. Seattle has about 22 families that have come in. In Spokane, we have 27 new families that have come in, and most of those families are 5 to 8 members. Those kids are going to school, and they have to take the public bus. The families are so scared to put their daughters on those buses because they're being yelled at or their scarves are being ripped off. So you have public defense classes that are being given to the kids and to women in general because this is happening. They don't know how to handle it.
Why are Syrian refugees coming to Spokane when they could come to Western Washington, maybe a friendlier place to them, or you don't think so?
You know, you don't get a choice as a refugee of where you're coming. It's the organization that's bringing you. They decide where they want to put you. You know, as an immigrant, you pick out where you want to go. As a refugee, you have nothing. So I think a lot of these organizations, World Relief or IRC, are spending in Spokane since it's less money for them to spend on them because they have to deal with them for 3 months, pay their housing, make sure they get a food allowance, food stamps, medical health care, this type of stuff.
How many Syrian refugees are in Western Washington, Puget Sound area anyway?
You know, just in this area right now that we know of, it's 22 families, which means, like I said, if each family member is 5 to 8 people, okay? And they mostly live in Tukwila, Kent, and West Seattle. So it's very hard for the community to get out there, but we do go out and see them and try and get them. And there's a lot of Americans that have been on my medical missions that are from the Seattle area. So they're spending time and going out, teaching them English, making sure they can drive, teaching them the American way of life, that type of thing. I mean, I'm taking 16 Syrian girls to the ballet because they've never seen a ballet. You know, it'll be really great for them. We had the people
Nutcracker?
Yes. And we have the people at Bainbridge did a Thanksgiving dinner for all the families. And it was 100 people. And they did the turkey, the stuffing, the whole thing. The families just loved it to the point where they go, okay, what do we do for Christmas now?
Rita, what do you want our listeners to understand about what's happening in Aleppo right now?
I just want them to understand that these are people that had nothing to do with this damn war. They're just innocent people, and they need help. And the way that people can help is please call your congressman, call your senators, call Obama, call the Russian embassy. Just call them and ask them for a ceasefire. It's really needed at this point. We need, you know, need to get medical care in there. We need to have Doctors Without Borders back in. They've been bombed out of there, so they can't even give treatment. I mean, at this point, just think of your own kids and you see them. You know, you send them out to school. Do you know if they're going to come back or not? That's what people have to remember.
Rita Zawida runs the humanitarian nonprofit Salaam Cultural Museum in Seattle. Right now, Rita is pulling together warm clothes and hygiene kits to take into Aleppo, and we're tweeting out a link to her organization if you want to learn more. And as Syrian refugees make their way slowly to new homes, they have to adjust to completely new lives. Andrew Kritovich knows what that's like. Kritovich is the program director of International Counseling and Community Services with Lutheran Community Services Northwest. He's also a refugee from Ukraine. He told Bill Radke that when he first got to America, going to the grocery store was too much to handle.
We came to U.S. and our relatives, they were here for about 2 years before us. So they were really experienced in life in the United States. So they said, okay, you will receive coupons in the mail. So you can cut those coupons, go to the store.
Coupons.
Yes. Yeah. And got stuff cheaper. So we got those coupons and we went to store. So we grabbed the milk. We went to the register. And person on the register, he was trying so hard to explain something to us. And our level of English, I have little British level of English. It was enough to say a few sentences. But when people were talking back, it was like one huge word without beginning and end.
Mm-hmm.
So I was only saying a milk coupon. And he was like explaining a milk coupon. And he stopped, he said, wait, okay? And I'm like, okay. So he ran to the back of the store, grabbed correct brand of milk, gave it to us and asked, okay? And I'm like, okay. And although, yes, it's kind of very simple task, right? When we go to store and we just buy in the milk for people who are born in the country or live here for a long time. But for new arrivals like we were when we came, any simple task was really hard. And even after that, I went home and I had almost emotional breakdown. I said to my wife, we didn't have kids at that time. So I said, at least before I knew how to buy milk. And now I feel I have no idea how to do even simple stuff. And that's what many refugees, they are going through this. Whatever is very easy for us or relatively easy, it's unimaginably hard for newly arrived refugees.
How can these emotional struggles affect the goal of settling here in America?
Very good question. For many of us, when we meet refugees, many of us can think, great, now you must be happy, you're in your country. But for refugees, it's impossible to release this experience. It's
to release
still
it.
There.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's still there. It's still hunt people. And many refugees are still in survival mode because of what happened. And same person is coming to the office and saying, my right shoulder hurts. And at first we would think, it's a medical issue. But then you ask, tell me more about this. And person is saying, I always sleep on my shoulder and I face the door. And then person is saying, and I understand that I'm here in the United States, but I feel I need to have knife by me under my pillow because I'm afraid that they can enter through the door. They can hurt my family again. So although people consciously, of course, understand that they're here in the United States, but it's really hard to deal with this emotionally when you're really emotionally affected, when you clearly remember how it happens and people are reliving this situation and people are trying to resolve it. But that's why many times we need professional conversation to really help people to go through this, to release this, to really vent a little above survival mode. Although many times it's easy to say, and it's not easy to do.
Yes. You're working as a mental health therapist now, Andrew.
Yes.
How do you do it? What do you do to help refugees process these kind of challenges?
First, and probably what is most important when we meet newly arrived refugees, we're really trying to normalize experience. We're really trying to say, whatever you experience, it's a normal reaction to very abnormal situation. Because many people, when they come in and they have those emotions, and they consciously know, I'm not there anymore, but emotionally, they are still there. And many people can think, am I crazy? What's going on? What's going on with me? So we're trying to really normalize it. We're trying to really say, whatever you experience, it's very normal human reaction. There is nothing wrong with the reaction. Situation is wrong. Because people usually don't talk about this. People casually don't talk like, I cannot sleep and I sleep only 1 hour. People try to hide this. But when they hear, other people experience this too. And then, of course, we have therapeutic interventions. And then, of course, we're trying to approach this situation holistically. We're trying to connect people with different support systems because we truly believe it's important to work through the emotional situation that happened. But it's also important to resolve immediate stressors people have, stressors of adjustment. And when we address these issues holistically, we see improvements.
My understanding is that there are countries where some of these refugees are coming from where the idea of seeing a mental health therapist is a hard one to get past.
Yes, even the term, in here, we use very, generally it's a neutral term, mental health therapy, mental health help. but it's impossible to interpret or translate this term into many languages, I would say majority of languages, without saying it's some kind of crazy situation. It's crazy. So instead of using term mental health, we use a lot emotional support, which it's more acceptable. Because, yes, for many people who are coming here, they're really afraid to be labeled as crazy. More than that, in many countries, psychiatric system, it is part of oppression. So refugees from many countries, they come in and they're kind of mistrusting this system because this system was abusing them. So it's really important, again, to normalize and to name it in a right term that is acceptable for newly arrived refugees to receive this help.
Andrew, we talked about your having an emotional breakdown yourself early on. Was there a turning point for you when you felt like, I can do this?
Probably starting my first job, where I really received the sense, I can do this. I can be also part of this society. First work, it's unimaginably important for many refugees. And majority of refugees, they're really looking for this hard. I want to work. I want to have a job. I want to be useful. I want to provide for my family. And actually, my first work was a security officer here in Seattle. And it was a great experience when I learned, yes, I can provide. Yes, I can also learn and do something.
I'll bet there are people listening to you right now who would like to help. What could people do in the Puget Sound area to help refugees resettle and live a fulfilling life?
What I would say, first of all, bringing awareness, helping on a level I can. I remember when we were going through this process, we had a lot of people we didn't know them, who just smiled in the right time, who provided help in the right time. And from all those little events, refugees, people who come in from bad situations in the world, they feel accepted. So we can all feel as part of one community. And we're really trying hard to bring refugees to level of self-sufficiency. Many success stories where refugees who were coming here just with two bags, but with a lot of hopes, and they achieve a lot in life.
Andrew Kritovich is the Program Director of International Counseling and Community Services with Lutheran Community Services Northwest. He talked with Bill Radke. Washington State's electors have cast their presidential votes from Olympia. The total in Washington State, 8 for Hillary, not for, 4 not for Hillary. So far, CNN reporting that no electors have gone against Trump at this point. This is putting Donald Trump one step closer to taking the office in January. Seattle Times economic columnist John Talton took a look at how Trump's economic policies will affect the Puget Sound region.
Hi, Patricia.
Okay, so overall, President Trump, good or bad for Puget Sound's economy?
I think at best we can say mixed. If he follows through on his plans and the GOP Congress plans, there will be huge tax cuts that will go to the richest people, and we have plenty of those. And there will be big cuts to social programs, which will hurt middle and low-income people here, including repealing Obamacare.
The trickle-down could be significant.
Well, that would fly in the face of the evidence we've had for the past 35 years. Because the rich typically are not cash-strapped, so they don't go out and spend their money. And companies invest less and less in workers now, which is why we're having such a productivity problem. And so there's very little in the Trump agenda that would really be a stimulus. Now, in the short term, with tax cuts and rolling back regulations and things like that, you will see some businesses flourish. In the long term, there are costs to that, costs to the social safety net, costs to the environment, costs from climate change that's unaddressed.
President-elect Trump says day one he's going to abandon the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Is that possible, and what would that mean for Washington?
I think TPP is dead, and maybe we do need a new trade paradigm. We have to understand that Donald Trump is not a normal president. He has no experience in office. He's not curious. He's unlike any president we've ever had in American history. And so if we're going to abandon the existing trade paradigm, what's going to replace it? Well, he hasn't really said. Washington is per capita the most trade-dependent state. It runs a trade surplus with the world. And so Washington stands to really be hurt if trade is curtailed or somehow disrupted. This doesn't have to have the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We might have benefited modestly. But if you want to abandon the whole ball of wax that's been trade done the American way for the past several decades, that's going to be disruptive.
You wrote about a report from the Milken Institute that looked at top-performing cities around the country. The report called us one of the world's most innovative regions, but it also warned that pressure on Boeing is the region's biggest liability. Do you agree with that? Do you think the pressure on Boeing is our biggest liability economically?
I think it is right now, and I think that we're seeing a very slow economy worldwide, and that affects jet plane orders. And so Boeing is already feeling those headwinds. It has also been attacked by Donald Trump, who has this habit of going after companies and then sometimes making nice, and Boeing is trying to make nice back. But it just shows you the really uncharted waters that we're in.
Yeah, what do you think will happen with that pressure on Boeing during the Trump administration? I mean, recently, their latest interaction with the president started with a tweet.
Well, we've never seen these kind of sudden, impulsive attacks. Now, on the other hand, Boeing is working hard to be collaborative, and it's a very smart company. But we have a lot on the line here, and we're really in new territory. There's nothing like this in American history.
Is there some kind of warning indicator that you're watching for in our economy that might give you a heads up that everything's about to change?
Well, sure. I mean, if we see a big drop in exports and imports in and out of the Puget Sound, if we see a big drop in housing prices, people might who want to buy might say, yay, but that might be a sign that the bubble, if you want to call it that, is popping. I'm certainly watching Amazon stock because we're very dependent on Amazon in the city and the region and the tech industry in general to make sure that that's not a bubble that pops. Those are a few of the things.
And as we move into a new administration, how should listeners be thinking about our region's economic strength moving forward?
This is a region that punches well above its weight economically. We are blessed with a very diverse economy, and we have so many strong points and so many assets. But we compete against the world, and we compete against world-class cities, and every other place in America wants what we have, so we can't take it for granted. And as we move into these uncharted waters, it's a strong economy. President Obama is handing Donald Trump a very strong economy compared to what he was handed. And the last thing I'll just say is this is a very old expansion, and it won't last forever. The question is whether we'll have a mild recession or whether Trump's policies will lead us into something worse.
All right. John Talton is the economics columnist for the Seattle Times. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Patricia.
And in late news today, Boeing told employees there will be more job cuts coming in 2017. The company says it's trying to reduce costs after intense competition and a weakening market for sales. Boeing's stock price this hour not impacted by that, up almost 1.5 points right now. Seattle is the fifth whitest city in America, and both Jen Peterson and Audra Boo are feeling that whiteness. Jen worked at KEXP and was the general manager at the Cloud Room on Capitol Hill. Audra Boo is a musician. They're both black women who have lived in Seattle for years. The presidential campaign and election shook them both. So now Jen Peterson says she's done. She told Bill Radke she's leaving for a new place, Mexico.
We live in a beautiful city, but I've been here since 92, and I've seen exponential change. And not that it's, change is a bad thing. I'm not throwing my hands up and crying in a corner. It's sort of now a rock in my river. It's not flowing like I used like it used to here.
How do you know you can make that internal change by changing your external surroundings?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know yet. I feel it. I want to watch this from afar. I don't want my money to stimulate this economy. And I hate to say that, but it's true. And I have a lot of friends that are saying, you know, you stay, fight the fight. That fight isn't new. And those who think it's new, I get it. I understand. I get you. You got a long road ahead of you, but it's a fight that we fought for a very long time.
We haven't really talked specifically about what it is that you aren't liking about Seattle now.
Being a woman in the workforce and having been afforded the opportunities that I've had, working the places that I've had, they've all been wonderful and great experiences. But again, I'm civic minded and I like numbers. And currently, and it might even be worse now, but Seattle is currently 7% black people, and 3% of those black people are employed. So people like Audra and I are unicorns when we walk into places like this as the workforce. I'm always one of one, one of two.
Will you talk about what that means to you and why that's important?
I realized when I went to Brooklyn for the first Afropunk, I sat on a bench. And I should have been watching bands, but I didn't know what I was in for. I sat on the bench and watched beautiful black people walk past me, and it still gives me goosebumps from my head to my toe. And I realized that I wasn't seeing that when I came back. And every time I would touch down in Seattle and I tell you this story, I cry. I get upset. And it takes me a minute to acclimate back to who I am here. Because I feel black there, and I love it.
What's your experience?
When we're speaking about blackness, you know, taking it back, like, yeah, we went to Brooklyn this year. It was me and a bunch of our friends who had never been to Afropunk. And I was only there just for the days of the festival. And immediately walking into the festival, there is the realization, the undoubted realization that this is not even all the black people in the city that we are in. When you walk into Afropunk, there are just all the shades of black and brown that you could ever imagine. Right. And I've not left the country by plane. We'll say, like, you know, Europe or any of those places, Africa. I've been Canada, Mexico. That's my reach. Going to Brooklyn and seeing all these black and brown faces, I immediately bust into tears, mm-hmm. and would proceed to spend a lot of the weekend in tears just at the realization there was a whole other festival going on. Was it Brooklyn Loves MJ that Spike Lee put on, mm-hmm. at the same time? And there's black people there, and they're not even the same. It's a profound experience to go somewhere, and it's, I don't even have to count. I don't have to think about it. Mm-mm. Here, what, in Seattle, like, I'm from here, I'm born and raised here. I love Seattle, too. But here, I'm always taking count. How many other black people are in the same space as me? Who else is in the room?
Some people listening know exactly what you mean, and some people might want to know, help me understand, why is it so important, the number of, so there's a lot of black people here, few black people here, why is it so important to you?
Equity.
Yeah.
Equity, not equality, equity, you know, is so important here, and the numbers are staggering. You see me just sit up, right? The numbers are staggering here. Seattle is 66% white, and 51% of those white people are men. You know, it's put it on that level, just right there for me. And you have to count. And it's not even that you have to. It's just that you do. You know, you walk into a room, and when Audra said that, I was like, yep, that happens innately in you in Seattle. You walk in, you're like, oh, one. you know, I'm the only person here. And you expect certain things. You know, you do that because you have to guard yourself.
Especially when you're a musician, a musician of color in Seattle, and how the changing landscape has made me realize more and more that I am sometimes the only black person in the room. As the country is turning in a direction, as being black is becoming so much harder, it just makes me look at who I'm in spaces with and what's the reception and how much of my actual self do I get to really be. Mm-hmm. And that has been, that alone has been, for me, really difficult. I just did a Nina Simone tribute night at Teatro Zanzani. And this was right after the election. And, you know, I knew that social media was going to explode. My black and brown Facebook going crazy, right? And it just, I was like, okay, I'm just going to like, ooh, I'm going to try to keep it strong. I'm going to try to just, you know, I'm not confrontational and I don't like to do politics. And it was so hard to remain mellow about what the future looks like. So, you know, I had a lot of problems with, even at this tribute, like Teatro Zanzani is a, it is a predominantly white crowd. And I was singing Young, Gifted, and Black right after Whitney Monge sung Strange Fruit in a crowd where I only spotted two black faces that were in chairs.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, dude, that was rough. Mm-hmm. That's rough. I've never, these last few years, and really more these last months, having to realize my blackness in white spaces, it's been tough. And when you add on to that I am a mother of two black children, and just ever since the 13-year-old in the park, mm-hmm, with the toy gun. Mm-hmm. The cops didn't even get out the car.
Tamir Rice in Cleveland.
Yes. Mm-hmm. 13. My son is 13. And it is every day in my mind that, like, being black, not only in Seattle, but all over the place, is a constant thing that we have to think about. I can't just wake up and just have my day. I don't have the privilege to do that.
You both mentioned that you were unhappy about the Trump election. There might be people listening who aren't black saying, we're not black, but we're liberal. We didn't vote for Trump. Seattle is liberal and embracing, and we love diversity. And, you know,
let's start showing it.
Tell me your experience.
You know what? Proof is in the pudding. If people want to say that, I need you to come from a space of actually knowing that that's happening. Put yourself, don't tell yourself that it's happening because you have a black friend. Don't tell yourself that it's happening because you went to a Nina Simone tribute. Don't tell yourself it's happening if it's not happening. There's no gray area there for me, honestly.
What's your experience? You're saying that you don't see it, that's just talk. What do you see? What do you guys feel?
As much as it can happen, it does happen, sure. I say open up more doors. Keep your head up more. If you really think it's happening, think again. Do more if you think it's happening. Find out where it's happening. Create spaces for it to happen. Most importantly, create those comfortable, safe spaces for it to happen. And yes, we are a liberal city, but let's start being it. We, you know, people used to say that we're passive aggressive. We're becoming more aggressive. I want to find my own way, somewhere else. Like Audra said, I never used to be so political, but I do worry daily now. And I worry for my friends. I worry for my family. I think it was right before the last debate. I was driving down I-5 and there were three gray planes that were parked at Boeing Field. And mind you, these gray planes were probably there just to get painted, you know, like Boeing or 777 or whatever. But the thought in my head was those are for us, meaning those are to take those black people from Seattle and ship them somewhere. And I know it's not true. It's just the first thought that came into my mind. And it has stayed, and I'm ready for that anxiety to go.
I'll tell you this. I'm not leaving. I'm not going anywhere. Me and my fiance, we just bought a house. And I have kids here, and I'm not going anywhere. I want to build and to have a foundation here that I can be proud of, that I worked for, that can't nobody take away. And I want my kids to know that, yeah, the world does suck, but it doesn't mean that you don't have to work for what you want. It doesn't mean that it's not sweet when you have earned it and you have it. I want them to know that regardless of where you are still black and beautiful and strong. And that is something that no one can erase.
That was singer Audra Boo and Jen Peterson, the former general manager at the Cloud Room. They talked to Bill Radke about Jen's decision to leave Seattle and Audra's decision to stay. She's performing at Numo's Friday night, the last show for her duo Fly Moon Royalty. We're tweeting out that link now. That's at KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy, in for Bill Radke.